Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you want to be. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This week, I'm joined once again by Jack Howard. Jack and I
Hello.
Are still isolated distantly. I'm still in Hampshire and Jack is still in the most exotically designed bedroom. What I love about your bedroom, because we're looking at each other through Zoom. Incidentally, if you're listening to this on the podcast and you want to see pictures of Jack and me having this conversation, then go to
which
the
I would recommend.
Page.
It's a very good looking pair.
It is, because the last time we did it, Jack, I think it turned out that you were dressed on your top half like James Bond, but on your bottom half you were still in your gym jams, which was...
Well, that's the thing, is I thought I'd make an effort for being on the first ever digital version of MK3D.
Yeah.
But it only comes up to here, so I can have the comfort on the bottom, and no one had to know, but I had to spoil the whole trick.
Please
for comedy.
Please tell me that you are fully dressed from the... Please tell me that you're not sitting there... In your pack, just let me know that you are fully dressed now,
Mark. I like the tension, and I'm not going to reveal it.
Okay, all right, fine. So anyway,
I also thought I'd let you know that this is a set. You know what I mean? Like, so it's not real.
It's not your real bedroom.
No, it's just cardboard cut out.
Anyway, if you'd like to enjoy all this visual delight, then go to the Patreon page and become a patron and support the podcast because it would be lovely to have you. Anyway, this is a slightly momentous podcast because in a conversation that Jack and I had recently, Jack revealed that he had,
yeah, had
never seen The Exorcist. This was, in fact, the first digital MK3D, the first online one. Jack revealed this again. If you want to see that, you can find it on the BFI's YouTube channel.
It was a confession that I thought I had to make at this point, because you can't get me, because we're separated by the law. So
separated by the law.
Yeah, because we're not allowed to be near each other at the moment. I thought it'd be best to tell you a confession, like I've never seen The Exorcist, via webcam, because I felt safer that way.
You know, there's a weird thing, because the last podcast that we did together, other than the MK3D, we did one about underrated movies. And one of my favourite underrated movies, I think it was like up there in the one spot, was Grace of My Heart. And you really didn't like it. And I got off my bike about it a little bit. My word. There was a lot of stuff on Twitter. It's interesting. Sometimes you don't know how harsh you sound, not you, one, until somebody on Twitter says, "My God, if somebody actually said to you, if you and him were in the same room, I would have punched him." And so I just wanted to say publicly, Jack, if I sounded at all outraged about your dismissal of Grace of My Heart, it was indeed.
I stand by everything.
Exactly. Anyway, but yeah, so...
No, not that didn't make me feel uncomfortable at all. It was exactly what I wanted. You know, it's always just fun to sort of rile each other up sometimes. And it's nice to see that we're both passionate either way. And it didn't get personal. It was fine.
No, of course not. No, I mean, my feeling entirely is that we know and respect each other enough that we can say, "You're an idiot and you don't know what you're talking
that's
about."
That's exactly it.
That's perfectly fine. So I just want to say...
If that person was sat with us and he punched you, that would have been a bang out of order. Because
hang on,
I'm just having a conversation with my friend. Who are you? I don't even know you.
Exactly. So I just want to make absolutely clear to all the listeners, okay, it's like mummy and daddy love each other. It's just every now and then they argue, you know.
That's exactly it.
You've so you've now sat down and watched, we haven't spoken to each other since this has happened. You've now sat down and watched The Exorcist. So the first thing I want you to do is I want you to describe for me the circumstances under which you saw it, and just lead me through the whole thing. I'm not even going to say
experience.
To you, did you like it? I just want you to just tell me what happened.
Understood. First of all, I think it's important to note that I watched the version you've never seen, I think, because and even though
classic original version is probably the safer bet, but actually I like the version you've never seen because it has certain textural things in it that aren't in the original.
Correct. But you recommended that I would start with the original, and that's what I tried to do, but I couldn't find it anywhere. Like the only version on iTunes was the version you've never seen, and it was very strange to not like. Yeah, it was just very strange.
I should say on the top shelf of my video shelf in our living room, there are literally 20 versions of The Exorcist. I mean, there are not only two versions of the film, but
it's all the same film.
There's a VHS, there's a DVD, there's a Blu-ray.
So the covers are a bit different.
Yeah, so exactly. My version is like which one would you like to watch with the stereo? Wow. So anyway, okay. So you went for the version you've never seen, which is obviously the version that Friedkin went back and redid in 2001.
In the year 2000, right?
Yeah. So just to fill in a little bit of background about this. When The Exorcist was first made, William Peter Blatty, who was the author and the producer, had certain scenes that he wanted included in the film that were in an original assembly of it. When Friedkin was in the final stages of the editing, he cut those scenes out because he felt that he needed the pace of the movie to be speeded up. He was reacting very specifically to a call by John Cowley, who was a Warner executive, who said, look, things like the first medical examination, take that out. The audience knows she's not possessed. It's called The Exorcist. They know that. There was a conversation on the stairs between Meron and Karis. What's the reason for all this? Why is this all happening? There was an exchange at the end between Kinderman and Karis, which Blatty felt were important to the carpentry of the story. And Friedkin took those scenes out, and Blatty was really, really heartbroken by that. And for years and years, he said, look, I want those scenes to be back in. And then when I made The Fear of God with Nick Jones in 1998, we found that those scenes still existed. But Friedkin at that point was still insistent that, they didn't want to go.
Another scene that wasn't included in the original, wasn't the spider walk gone?
Yeah, so the spider walk was a slightly different case because the spider walk was never.
It's because of the wires, right?
Yeah, it was never in a. Well, there was a number of problems with the spider walk, and in fact, if we talk through the film, we'll get to the spider walk when we get.
We'll
to
do
it.
That.
But then in 2000, after ages and ages of Blatty saying, "Look, I really want these scenes back in." Friedkin agreed, and he said the reason when people are wrong when they call the version you've never seen a director's cut, they're both the director's cut. The first one was Friedkin's cut, and the second one was Friedkin's cut many years later. And he said to me when I interviewed him about it, he said, Bill had been asking me to put all this stuff back in the movie for all these years, and I just felt, okay, why not? And then he also put in the spider walk because obviously by that point there was a way of doing it. And the feeling was if we're going to put these dialogue scenes in, why don't we put that back in? But the essential thing is it's character building stuff. It's the first medical examination. It's the conversation on the stairs. It's that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And that conversation on the stairs as well, I think I saw, it might be the interview you did, but he said that he didn't feel like he wanted to have that in because... it was explaining the movie, and the movie itself was saying that, so he didn't want to. He didn't feel like it needed a statement. But
yeah, his quote was.
I think it's good for another reason. But we'll get to that sort of stuff. Yeah, if we're going to talk about the movie.
So set me up. Okay, so you've gone for the version you've never seen, which is Blatty's preferred cut, and actually I think it's now Friedkin's preferred cut. So to set the scene. You're in your front room. But who else is there with you? What's the story?
So it's just me on my own. I've waited as long as I can for it to get dark, because it doesn't at the moment. Shut all my curtains, shut all my blinds, got comfy, got my little notepad because I wanted to have some things that I specifically wanted to say for when I was watching it. I wanted to remind myself. No lights on, just let it get darker progressively as the movie continued, so the room just got darker with me naturally. It was lovely because it's been a while since I've put my phone away to watch a movie, because at the moment, a lot of the time I'm watching things with people virtually. So like we're texting each other back and forth when things are happening and all the rest of it. But this is the first time for a while that I've sat and watched a movie and been like, I'm watching a movie and that's all I'm doing. I'm just engaging with this. And it's brilliant, Mark. Of course it is. Of course it's brilliant. I mean, I'm not saying anything new here. Like, obviously it's a, you know, it's held up as the greatest horror movie of all time 40 something years later. Is it 40?
Came out in 73. So, I mean, it's, you know, the anniversaries are flying by. I mean, it's terrifying. Our documentary of 25 years of The Exorcist was 21 years old when it went back onto iPlayer just recently. I mean, those are the anniversaries.
Wow. Well, that's the thing, is that, and that's something I really noticed about it from the word go, was that it holds up really well. Like, the filmmaking is, it's like pre-Jaws. And when I think about Jaws, I think that's when Spielberg like shifted filmmaking into a much more like, I don't know, like there's something about Spielberg's filmmaking that feels updated. There's something when I watch like old movies sometimes, like the way that the camera moves or doesn't move, or when it doesn't cut, like to me feels like very like baggy sometimes, whereas Spielberg felt like he like sped up storytelling. And actually that's how The Exorcist feels to me, and it predates all that, so obviously my perception is off. So yeah, the editing in this like immediately caught me off guard, going from really silent landscapes and just almost hypnotically watching people just hammer, and then all of a sudden like you go into a loud noise immediately, and it's just immediately putting you off and offsetting me. And I'm like, okay, this is the sort of stuff that people are trying to do. In when people are saying that horror's got I keep thinking of reconnaissance because you've drilled that word into my head. Sorry. So now I can't think of the real word.
Renaissance.
So I just keep thinking of reconnaissance. That's your fault, that is. I think that when people are saying that horror is having a renaissance right now, it's like that's the sort of stuff they're trying to emulate. The things that people are gravitating towards, I think, in Hereditary, especially Hereditary, like Midsommar, is that weird, unsettling, eerie editing. Like the filmmaking is giving you a weird feeling as well, because it's just off. And I wasn't expecting it to start where it started. I knew that Max von Sydow, is that his name? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, I mean technically Max von Sydow, but yes, Max von Sydow is fine.
I know that he was a major part of The Exorcist, but I wasn't expecting it to start with him and then for him to not be in it for the next hour and 20 or something like that. So it was really, really just that just made me go, that's really clever, just because otherwise he would have been a deus ex machina, but we already met him. He was the first person we met, so our expectations were that this is the guy that we're going to be following and he's going to be, but no, the story. And also there's another Trojan horse, because you're thinking, oh, that this is the story about the little girl who gets possessed, when actually overall the story's about the priest who's lost his faith and is struggling with guilt over his dead mother and her having dementia, and coming to terms with the fact that horrible things happen to people and you can't really explain them sometimes. And the horrific thing about it, the story being that it wins, that he can't beat it and it takes his life. And that is just so heavy and such a big story and such an amazing way of telling it. Because I think that there's obviously a debate about religion in the movie, and it comes across as kind of pro-religious in some ways, and that feels to me like very surface level conversation about, they feel to me more like icons to play with to tell this more complicated story about a human being dealing with something awful. And the best way of telling that story was through these archetypes of devils, and literally devils and gods. Because when you break it down, that's what Batman and the Joker are. Do you know what I mean? Like, I saw this amazing like thing recently. Oh, I'll have to remember the guy's name. Max something, maybe, I can't remember. But he did this amazing presentation about why you relate to The Dark Knight so much is because it's playing with archetypes, and Bruce Wayne is the protagonist and the devil is the Joker and the angel is Batman. And then when they're having that conversation in the interrogation room, that's them meeting each other for the first time. The same as in Jurassic Park with Jeff Goldblum and...
Sam Neill? Richard Attenborough.
Richard Attenborough. I was going to say David Attenborough, which is obviously wrong. Richard Attenborough are having a conversation. Every time they have a chat, it's the devil and God having a conversation. And that is just using an archetype to put forward a larger story. And that's exactly what's happening here, I think, is that they're using those same devil and angel archetypes to explore the torment of Damien. I found it to be a very... personal story or very human story told in an extremely stylized, horrific, eerie, messed up way, and way more messed up than I expected for the 70s. That must be a weird thing, that I think that things get worse as they get old, like people get more daring as they get older, but this was more out there than most horror that I see these days, and made more sense. Like, the reason why I don't like Hereditary is because all of a sudden it becomes about it becomes about ghosts and stuff. It becomes about all of that, or like supernatural stuff all of a sudden, and I hated that because I was really enjoying this horrific, like tense, horrible take on an upsetting things that happened to this family, and then all of a sudden it goes, no, it's about supernatural stuff. The same way as Midsommar is like horrible again, it's gross. It's this opening 10-15 minutes of an unhealthy, toxic relationship being displayed, and then all of a sudden it goes, nah, I'm gonna do it about cults now. And I'm not interested in this. This is not as compelling. Whereas The Exorcist, I think, again, not saying anything new, because I literally have just seen it when everyone else has been like, yeah, we've known this for 40 years. The Exorcist is doing huge things by telling a story. The Exorcist is telling a very small story, horrible, upsetting story using huge imagery and huge ideas, and I thought it was great, and filmmaking as well. Like I said, the editing really stood out to me. That sort of constant sort of pulsating from quiet to loud just immediately just sort of offsets you, and that continues through the whole thing. And even just imagery from the start as well, I remember Max von Sydow like putting his hand into just a dark hole. And that's me. Well, that's what the movie is. I mean, that the whole movie is this: is the tension of someone putting their hand somewhere and wondering if something's going to grab it.
Putting their hand in a dark hole and going,
oh, he's got it. And if you're watching it on the Patreon, you'd be able to see what we're talking about right now. But I'm not going to reveal it for the audio listeners. This is Patreon exclusive right here. So yeah, like those are my rambling sort of thoughts about how I felt about The Exorcist.
Somewhere between science and superstition, there is another world. The world of darkness. Nobody expected it. Nobody believed it, and nothing could stop it.
There are no experts. You probably know as much about possession as most priests.
Okay, so look, there's so much to talk about. I mean, seriously, we could
try and break it down.
We can now talk for about sort of 4 hours. So there are many things that I want to pick up on. The first one is something that you said early on, which is that the story is about it's not about the little girl, and this is absolutely right. One of the reasons that Blatty's sequel Legion isn't about Reagan is that the story isn't about Reagan, and in fact, that scene on the stairs, in a break in The Exorcism, Karras says to Marin, "It makes no sense. Why this girl?" And Merrin says, and there have been various longer, shorter versions of this scene, and as it is now, he says, I think the idea is to make us, you know, doubt that God could love us, to make us feel ultimately ugly and bestial. And the point is that that scene, that abridged scene, is a shortened version of a longer scene in the book, in which Merrin says very specifically, the target isn't her. It's us. It's everyone in the house. It's everyone who's seeing this. And as you rightly remembered, what Friedkin did say this in the documentary that Nick Jones and I made, The Fear of God. He said, for me, the whole movie is about what they're talking about. So why are they talking about it? And they took that scene out. And that scene was, for Blatty, the thing that was most important about going back into the film. The moment of why is this all happening? Okay. And it's in Merrin's explanation is, it's to make us despair. The demon, you know, is attempting to make everyone despair. And actually, and you're completely right, the story is about Karras's loss of faith. It is not. I mean, there's a question about whether the exorcist is Max von Sydow or whether the exorcist is Karras. I mean, actually, the exorcist of the title is Max von Sydow. It's him standing outside the house on Prospect Street. When we first meet him in that sequence that you were talking about in Iraq, which, again, there's a lot of fights about, there was originally in Blatty's original screenplay, he'd taken the Iraq sequence out because he just thought it wouldn't work cinematically. It was Friedkin who said, you have to put the Iraq sequence back in. And what's really interesting about the Iraq sequence is that it sets up everything that's about to happen in the movie. In terms of the imagery, you get this thing about, you know, you get the hammering, which mirrors the hammering of the bed later on. You get the woman in the fast-moving droshky with the eye, which prefigures the kind of the old face of Reagan when she gets possessed. And also the guy who's hammering in the smelt who has the whited-out eye, which we see later on with Reagan.
Also, you get the hammering is very reminiscent of the holy water.
It is. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And all the way through, you get these series of images that will then basically recur throughout the film. And Friedkin says he very specifically constructed the film in the editing as a kind of conversation between light and dark. Very bright, very dark, very loud, silent. I mean, the Exorcist is full of loud silence. It's full of things going bang, 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 and then a silence afterwards. And on a sensory level, it is extraordinary. But also, absolutely, you're right that you meet Merrin, and he's there at this dig in Nineveh, and he finds these two things together. One of them is the Pazuzu head, and the other is a medallion, which, incidentally, this is an invention of the film, which is they're in the same. Why are they in the same place? It's ancient and modern. What are they doing there?
And the best thing about that as well is that he seems uneasy about it immediately.
Yeah.
Like there's something in his performance that makes you curious about what's going on, because
exactly.
he's so like moved by it, and you can't quite read what it is. Is it fear? Is it what is going on? And so there's so much story there already.
But of course, what's interesting is the thing that he says with is evil against evil, because the statue, the little statuette, the amulet of Pazuzu, is something that was used superstitiously as evil against evil, that you have the amulet, and that the amulet of that will scare off other demons. It's a really weird thing. That medallion then appears later on in Karras's dream, and then that medallion appears around Karras's neck, and that medallion is ripped off Karras and ends up being given to Chris McNeil. This is like a kind of weird thing, that how can it be in all these different places? And there isn't any explanation other than what he was trying to do was to create the idea that there were two things happening in separate parts of the world, almost in separate time frames. I mean, it's almost like the Iraq sequence is from an ancient world and the Georgetown sequence is from a modern world. Mm-hmm. And those things collide in Karras's dream of his mother. When Karras has the dream in which there is the medal, there are the dogs from the prologue, which he can't possibly have seen. There are all these different images that are sort of put together in that dream sequence. There is the flash frame of the demon face. So my question, however, is, you said that Karras is overwhelmed by grief at the death of his mother, and he, that's absolutely what's happened. And he says, you know, I think I've lost my faith. And you said, I think that that your reading of the story was that, that the demon wins, or that the not the, the evil force wins, that he is so despairing that he throws himself to his death. Okay,
that is so my that my reading of it is that the that he is overwhelmed by his demons.
Okay, that is, and this is an interesting point, and I mean this with the greatest respect, that is 100% not what happens. But what's in but what's interesting is that it's also the source of the controversy about putting the extra material back in. So
Oh, interesting, okay,
so from Blatty's point of view, Blatty was a I knew Bill well, okay? And Blatty was a Catholic. He was educated by Jesuits. He was a very, very devout Catholic, and he believed, he was inspired to write The Exorcist, having read about a story in 1949 about the possession of a young boy in Mount Rainier, about which we now subsequently know more, and it looks like that story was bunk, but doesn't matter. Bill was absolutely, Bill Blatty was absolutely convinced by this this reported story in 1949 about demonic possession, and he did a paper on it in college, because he thought that if there are demons, then there are angels, right? If there is such a thing as demonic possession, then there is an afterlife. Then there is a, it's like proof. It's proof of the existence of God. Bill himself, there's no secret about this, he wrote a whole book about it, was very traumatized by the death of his own mother. And he was somebody who was desperate for proof of the afterlife. And at this particular point in his life, when he wrote The Exorcist, he was somebody who was really, really sort of fascinated by proof of transcendence. In his mind, and in the narrative of The Exorcist, the novel, and indeed of the script of the film, the journey is this. Karras, who is a priest, encounters the death of his mother and the you know what happens to his mother, and he becomes so distraught by it that he actually says to his friend Father Birmingham, Father Tom Birmingham, who actually is a priest, he says, "I think I've lost my faith." He is then suddenly confronted with proof of transcendence. The central irony of the film is that Chris McNeil, the mother, who is an atheist who doesn't believe in God, comes to believe that her daughter is possessed by the devil. She goes to a priest of faltering faith and says, "I want you to perform an exorcism." And he's the one who doesn't believe. She is somebody, she says, "I've been to 99 doctors with all their bullshit. They all tell me the same thing. Now you're going to send me back to them," because she's run out of options. So Karras then goes and he sees Reagan in this state, and he does everything he can to try and disprove that she's possessed. He sprinkles holy water on her that isn't holy water, and she reacts very badly. Okay, so she's putting it on. In the novel, there's an awful lot more stuff about him asking, did she know a priest was coming? No, I didn't tell her. Well, how did she know? Well, maybe she just figured it out because of the way, blah, blah, all that sort of stuff. And he tries to disprove that she's possessed. And what happens is, as a result of the encounter with her, he comes to believe that she is. Now, there is a key moment, which is in the film, in which he is asked by his superior, "Are you convinced that it's real?" And he says, "No, but I'm convinced that I've made a prudent judgment as that it meets the criteria laid down in the ritual." Meaning, no, I don't know that I believe it, but I believe that I have prudently judged that we should go forward, okay? Then Merrin turns up. Merrin, who we met at the beginning, who is a man of unshakable faith, who has met this demon before, okay? We know that there has been an encounter from them before. We also know that Merrin performed an exorcism in Africa, blah, blah, damn near killed him. Merrin turns up, and Merrin is the steadfast, there is no debate about this. And, Karras says, "I think, I'd like to tell you about the multiple personalities that she's..." "There is only one." And then Karras wants to tell him about all the conversations he's had with the demon, and Merrin says, "First rule, do not engage in conversation with the demon. Do not. You don't do that. That is a demon. She is possessed." And then Merrin dies. I'm sorry, this is a plot spoiler, but the film's 40 or whatever years. Then Merrin dies. And there is a crucial moment when Chris McNeil says to Karras, is she going to die? Because the girl is really ill. She's upstairs in the room and she is dying. And Karis says no. And he goes upstairs and he finds Merrin dead on the floor. So that's it. And the demon is there, the girl, laughing at him. And he loses it. Now, the conversation, the question about what then happens in that room, to this day, is something which people argue about, okay? But the narrative, as far as Blatty's concerned, is this. He loses his temper. He grabs the girl, because he now believes that this is a demonic force. And he grabs the demon and he says, take me, come into me. And that happens in the film as well. Take me, come into me. And in the novel version is slightly different. The novel version is slightly more ambiguous about what's happening. You just know that Karis says something like, "Oh, you're very good with little girls. Try someone your own size." Okay, and then what happens in the Blatty is that the demon goes into Karis, and Karis throws himself out of the window to get the demon out of the house, and Karis triumphs. Karis's faith is restored. He falls down the bottom of those stairs. Joe Dyer is there, reads him the last rites, says, you know, are you sorry for all your sins of the world? And he does that to say yes. And he is saved. And he is saved. And he, I'm sorry to be this blank about it, and he goes to heaven. That's the narrative of Blatty's story. But what's really interesting is that since the film came out, people have watched it and believed that Karis despaired and threw himself out the window
I think that that's because, you know, obviously artistic interpretation and all the rest of it, and does it matter what the author intended? It's how the audience receives it, and that to me feels like it's a reading of the film as a religious text.
But that's
that single perspective on the film is,
yeah,
a man's struggle with religion and faith, and then by the end of it he gains it back enough to be able to transcend to heaven.
Exactly.
But my initial thinking of it wasn't as a religious person, because I'm not, so I wasn't really too engaged with that journey. I was absolutely empathetic towards that idea of losing something so important to you that once seemed to make so much sense. Obviously I could relate to that, but to me it felt more like the imagery of a demon, and the jumping out of a window is such a suicidal thing to do, and the idea of the phrase like fighting with your demons and all the rest of it feels to me more like a reading of his mental health and his mental state after dealing with the death of his mother, rather than his struggle with whether or not heaven's a place.
Push it! All right, get back!
Do you want to make a confession? Are you sorry for having offended God with all the sins of your past life? He goes to himself and upon me was become his tools. And when he partners it, he deserves it.
And here, Jack, is why the film is brilliant.
Exactly.
Because it is possible to read it in any number of ways. In the novel, Kinderman actually does come to the conclusion, at least for the police purposes, Kinderman the detective, who it's kind of a weird character, because Kinderman turns up, does a lot of investigating, and then sort of seems to disappear. But there is a thing in the novel in which Kinderman does, the official police conclusion is that Karis, overcome by grief at the death of his mother, committed suicide. But what's really fascinating is that there's two voices in this story. One of them is Blatty, who was absolutely, you know, Catholic through and through, and had one reading of the story. And then there was Friedkin, who, you know, comes from a Jewish family, and at that point was agnostic, now describes himself as somebody who is, open. He's made a very interesting documentary about Father Amort, who was the Vatican exorcist, And he's somebody who's, you know, who's wrestled with the idea that there is more in the world than we know, but he's not doctrinal in any way at all. But what's fascinating about The Exorcist is it's like two voices, two separate voices. One of them, the guy who made the French connection, the guy who's telling this story as a human story, as a, mm-hmm. you know, as a, and which you can, as you just have done, read as a story about somebody's mental health. And then there's the other story, which is it's a story about tangible, you know, proof of the existence of God. And what's astonishing about it, because I know how I read the story, because, you know, I know what the story means to me. But it's so brilliant to hear somebody read it as a different story. And it you know, makes, because some people would say, for example, well, it's clearly a supernatural story. She levitates. Okay? She levitates. You know, this is not natural. But the weird thing,
yeah, but
the
whole film is so dreamlike and strange and all the rest of it, that just because it's literally happening in front of you doesn't mean that it's literally happening for a story.
Yeah. And also,
come on.
Yeah, exactly. And also, crucially, the, you know, the 360 degree head turn, which of course isn't in the novel. In the novel, her head just, Chris gets her head knocked, and she thinks that Reagan looks all the way round, because it's a reference to Burke Dennings. It's a reference to the fact that Reagan has thrown Burke Dennings out the window. That's why the first, in which she says, "You know what she did, your daughter." The reason that the head goes all the way round is because Dick Smith had built the dummy to do the 180-degree turn, and they thought, well, we might as well put it all the way round. And Blatty said, that's just, you can't do that. If a head goes all the way round, it'll fall off. So they put a cutaway to Karis, and that cutaway is really important, because that cutaway, halfway through the head turn, suggests that everything you're seeing, it's in his head. Her head doesn't go all the way round. He sees something. The moment that she levitates, it cuts to him, like, look, you know, and Max von Sydow is spraying the holy water, going, and Karis is just like that. And of course, that moment is really, really important, because in the novel, that's the moment when he's going, this is happening. This is actually happening. Look, she's levitating. And then immediately he starts thinking, well, yeah, but maybe it's poltergeist phenomenon, maybe it's telekinetic energy, you know, maybe, you know, just because somebody levitates, it doesn't mean it's demonic possession. Or maybe she isn't levitating, maybe it's a mass, maybe it's some kind of shared hysteria. And so what's fascinating,
it could also just be a demonstration of how he's feeling at that point. Like, it doesn't need to be literally a little girl levitating in a bed. It could just be like, that's how it feels like to be in this room. It feels like that something that huge is happening.
Well, I mean, I agree. And I just think that it's, I mean, I'm almost more delighted that you like it as a totally different film to the film that I like.
Yeah,
because in a way,
there's similar things in there, and the thing is, I enjoy hearing that perspective on it, because that is just a reminder again of something that I adore, and the reason why I enjoy stories and films so much is because you do bring your own stuff to it, and it does allow you to see and learn more about yourself by how you're reading something. The fact that I read it as more of a mental health story tells me a lot about me. Like, that I understand more about my perspective on something now because of how I read this film, that nobody else will, you know, read exactly the way that I did, because I'm bringing my own stuff to it. And I think that's to me feels like a better film and a better story than one that's just clear cut, this is what it's about.
No, I completely agree. I mean, I think, for example, that the people think about the special effects and, you know, and all that stuff. But actually, I think that the most powerful scenes in the film are, I think the scene when Karis is in the bar and he says, I think I've lost my faith, is brilliant. I think the scene when he has to go with the uncle to visit his mother in the hospital is just heartbreaking. I think the scene when he goes to see his mother in her apartment and, you know, and she's, you know, and she's got the radio on, and she's been alone for all that time, and he arrives. It's this, I think, and he arrives, and she, and she opens her eyes and she's been sitting in the art and she goes, dear me, dear me, dear, and you know, and that scene is almost, I think, the best scene in the film, because you then what you understand is everything about his guilt and his grief and his, you know, I should have been there, I wasn't there, I should have been there. And then, of course, we get the dream sequence, which has got all the image of his mother, which incidentally is in the novel. His mother comes out of the subway and he calls out to her, but she can't hear him. And then there's the dogs, and then there's the thing. And also there's a brilliant cut after he says, Tom, I think I've lost my faith. And it cuts to suddenly a low angle outside the house on Prospect Street with the leaves blowing, and inside Chris McNeil on the phone, fucking operator, get me that, you know, and that's when things really go badly wrong. So it is about, I mean, his faith is his mental health, because of course he is a psychiatrist and a priest.
Yes.
The whole point about the reason he's brought in is they go, well, it wouldn't hurt to have somebody with psychiatric background, because that's what his character is. He is a priest and a psychiatrist. And it's so fascinating that you can read the film. You know that for you, the religious part of it is just the, you know, it's the
to me,
dressing.
It's more like, it's more metaphorical. It's more like what I said at the beginning, which was that there are archetypes to be played with to tell this story about a human being's experience, yeah, rather than it being literally about a religious, because that also helps me as well, because I don't believe in any of that stuff, to believe that a girl in a story can be possessed by the devil and that they're not going to be like, no, it's not. That there's no debate about whether or not she's possessed. As far as the audience is concerned, she is possessed from word go. Like, we can see her transforming. We can hear her voice changing. So when all that stuff is happening, it helps me to understand it as, oh, this is a vehicle to tell a different story. And whose story is that? Oh, it's Damien's. Like, yeah. I can now immediately attach all that to his story and link the two, and that's how it made sense to me.
The one hope, the only hope, the exorcist.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What did you think of the special effects work? I mean, obviously, at the time...
Incredible.
Okay, great.
Honestly, so nothing really... In the same way that you can watch Jurassic Park and understand that it was the beginning of CGI and go, this still holds up. Like, looking at 1973's The Exorcist... Obviously, it's been updated slightly because I watched the 2000 version where they painted out wires and things like that. Mm. But it's just great. Like, there's nothing... Like, the bed shaking, the bed levitating, her levitating. If it's green screen or something... I was so probably involved with the story that it didn't even really make a difference to me. And so sparingly used and, like, beautifully photographed that it just works in the same way that Jurassic Park does. It just still works. That T-Rex at night scene just still works.
There's no digital work on the special effects except for the spider walk, and that the spider walk. That's it. I mean, the rest of it is all, everything you see happening is happening. I mean, it's really...
I think that the image of that woman upside down opening her mouth and blood coming out is just going to be like, as far as, you know, some of the other images I had seen before, that's a new one that's burned into my brain now. So
yeah,
that's good.
So that's not in the original version. I'm just going to stop my phone. So that obviously is not in the original version, and that, weirdly enough, it was an outtake. In the original version of the spider walk, She comes down the stairs.
And she sticks her tongue out and chases somebody.
She flips over and she runs around and she licks Sharon's ankle. And they just couldn't make the thing work. It looks clunky. Nick and I put a version of it together in The Fear of God. They then had this second out, which actually both Blatty and Friedkin had forgotten about doing, which is that she comes down the stairs and then opens her mouth and the blood comes down her face, which is the version that's in the film now. Though the quick moment when you see her coming down the stairs, you could see the wires, and the wires have been digitally taken out. So, but it is still a physical stunt. It just is a physical stunt with those wires removed. The interesting thing is, in the original version, and this is one of the reasons, when they couldn't make the spider walk work, it actually enabled one of the best cuts in the film that is now not in the new version, which is this, that after Chuck turns up, okay, and Chuck says, you know, Chris comes home, the window's open, Reagan's in her room, Burke's not there, Sharon comes back from the chemist, right? She says, where were you? You left Reagan alone in her room. And she says, no, I didn't. I left her with Burke. Because Burke's a drunk. We know all that. Burke's gone out, okay? And then and she says, you know, what? How was it with the doctors? Oh, we've got to go and find a shrink. We've got to do something, you know. And she's despairing, okay? She says, we've got to find a psychiatrist. She's despairing. Then there's a knock at the door. This is all in both versions of the film. And Chuck comes in and he says, I guess you heard. And she says, what? And he says, Burke's dead. And she looks at him like, and he says, he must have been drinking. He fell down the stairs by the side of the house. And Chris she's like, it's like this one body blow too many, right? And she screams and she puts her head against the wall and she goes, no, you know, like bangs her head on the wall, okay? And it fades in the original version and it fades to black. She just literally, fades to black. And then what you hear is, Reagan, when I touch your forehead, open your eyes. And then the camera, and it's straight into the psychiatrist scene. Mm-hmm. In the version now, she goes boom, like, you know, thing. And then she turns round. And then she looks up, and then she sees Reagan coming down the spider walk. And Blatty always said the problem is that the scene's got three climaxes to it.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, I think that although the spider walk was a great thing to find, and I was the first person to see the footage of the spider walk for 25 years when it was in the Warner, and we saw just the outtakes and the bits, and I didn't see the blood man. I saw the original version of it, and it was like really creepy. But actually, in the construction of the narrative, I really loved that clip when she's this last thing that Burke has done is she closes her eyes, and it's like the film closes its eyes, and then you hear the psychiatrist go, Reagan, when I touch your forehead, open your eyes, and then with
and I think that sort of stuff as well adds to the what I was saying about the dreamlike nature of the film, because a lot of it is just Reagan does something, the demon does something horrible. We then cut away to something else. We then go back into her room and it's gotten worse somehow. And then she'll maybe come out of her room and something else will happen and then it will cut back to her room and she's just back in the bed again. So this is this constant resetting of, and you're not thinking about the idea of what's happening in between, because that's not what the film is about.
No.
It is about like these little shocking, dreamlike, strange, nightmarish moments that then because when she spider walks down the stairs, the next time you see her, she's somewhere else. And I'm like, what did you do in between? Like, did you ask her? Like, what was that about? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, there's none of this, like,
did you
filler
ask
stuff.
Her what that was about? Reagan?
Why isn't she telling anybody that she walked backwards down the stairs? What a bizarre thing to leave out.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, that's the other thing is one of the other reasons that scene kind of probably didn't make the original cut was it was, I mean, I remember Marcel Vecouter saying this. It was almost like, after that, you're going to speak to a psychiatrist. She literally just walked backwards down the stairs. She's not mentally.
And that's the thing is that, like, I always think about movies that can be parodied, and I think that this film is, you know, ripe for parody and has been parodied and referenced over and over and over again. And it's because it's taking itself seriously as in terms of a story, because it's not questioning these moments and saying this literally just happened, why are you not doing this, because it's just showing you all that matters in terms of an emotional arc for characters that are in the story, rather than pointing out that we know this is silly. Like, it's really taking its ideas seriously.
The other thing is, I think, like, one of the best scenes in the film for me is the scene when Kinderman interviews Chris, and it's a scene in which, you know, it's the scene in which Chris realizes that Reagan has thrown Burke Dennings out the window, but it's all said through what isn't said. Because, you know, Kinderman turns up and he's, you know, Miss McNeil, I can think, you know, I don't know, this Mike turns up and he stays with you for 5 minutes and he leaves. It's unlikely, you know, maybe a part, maybe somebody. How could it be? It could be one way. Maybe if somebody came calling, you had a part. And in the novel, there's a whole thing about suspicion being thrown on Carl, who earlier on we've seen Burke Dennings calling a Nazi. And he, I am Swiss, yeah. You know, all that stuff. And in the novel, there is a whole subplot about Carl and Elvira having a daughter, Carl and Willie having a daughter called Elvira, who is, it's the crucible of good thing. It's, you know, evil is the crucible of good, that some good comes out of this that nobody in the house ever knows about, which is that Elvira stops being a drug addict and is got into a rehabilitation program. Anyway, that's not in the film. But that scene in which they're sharing cups, you know, she's making him a cup of tea, and her hand is shaking because she's realizing from what he's telling her that Reagan has thrown Burke Dennings out the window. Mm. And she's just desperate for him to leave, and she's desperate for him to not ask her. And then there's that moment when she says, more coffee? And he should say no. And he says, yes, please. And you go, he's not going.
And then you find out that the reason is because he's also a fan of her and likes just being in her company. And it's this very strange... That's a horrific reveal as well. That's the thing I liked about it, is that there's this constant... On her, especially for the first portion of it, like, the horror is in the reaction to things. Like, the reason why those things are scary, really, that are happening to this little girl, is because you can see when she's being operated on, when she's having the needle put in her neck, you can see on that, you're obviously cringing at the imagery anyway, but you can see on the mother's face just how horrific this is for her to watch someone like that, someone as close to you go through something like that, and to not understand it, and to be afraid of it, and to be afraid what it means about her, that if it's not supernatural, what does it mean about her brain?
Also every event, every horrible event, is actually this is funnily enough a kind of a Spielberg connection. What happens is, you see the camera will run down the corridor towards that door. Okay, like every time they open that door, what's it going to be this time? Okay, runs down the door, like the crucifix scene, which is the worst one. Run down the door. Door opens. The first thing you see something is her going.
Yeah,
and then you see what it is,
and I think that's doing two things. I think that's sort of placing you with her, so that you're
it's about her.
It's about her, but it's also building more suspense because you're like, let me see it. Like there's two things going on there, like, and it's so brilliantly demonstrated.
But it's also, weirdly enough, it's a precursor of that thing that happens in Jurassic Park or happens in it's the before you see the dinosaur, you see either Sam Neill or Jeff Goldblum going,
yeah.
You know, it's you believe what you're about to see because you believe that they believe it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, it happens in Jurassic Park a lot. The thing that sells you the special effect is the reaction on everyone's face. And of course, in The Exorcist, it is the crucial thing that it's not her. It's not about her. I mean, the point is, there's a lovely line in the novel, which isn't in the film, in which Chris McNeil says to Joe, to Father Joe, about Karis. He never met her. You know, Karis has been in that room all the time. But that's not Reagan. And there's a thing when, you know, when that scene which is in the trailer, in which she says, you show me Reagan's double, everything down to the way she dots her eyes, and I know in an instant it's not my daughter. And I'm telling you, that thing upstairs is not my daughter. And as I said, there's that lovely callback to it, and then when he says he never met her, and I think about this film a lot. And I think that those things, in the end, those things are the things that make it work. The things that you're talking about, the psychological depth of it, the character depth of it, the fact that you can read it as a story that is not about, you know, God and angels and
supernatural
and that you can just read it as a psychological study is what makes it genius.
You ask me what I think is best for your daughter. 6 months under observation in the best hospital you can find.
You show me Regan's double. Same face, same voice, everything. And I'd know it wasn't Regan. I'd know in my gut. I'm telling you that thing upstairs isn't my daughter. Now, I want you to tell me that you know for a fact that there's nothing wrong with my daughter except in her mind. You tell me you know for a fact that an exorcism wouldn't do any good. You tell me that!
I guarantee you this. If you watch it again, and you know, maybe you will, and incidentally...
I'll give it a while, I think.
Yeah, but have a look. If you do, have a look at the original cut, the 73 cut, because now you've seen the fuller... I've got a copy.
Send you one of the copies.
Whichever. You want it Betamax, you want it VHS, you want it... I'll send you a copy. You'll be okay. But I guarantee you this, it'll look like a different film.
Mm.
Because every time... And the most amazing thing for me is this. I did all this work on it. I wrote a book. I did a radio thing. I did the documentary. You know, we got the outtakes and the sound tapes and the dummy, and I interviewed everybody. I took that film apart, and then you play it and it works. And there are so many things that you take them apart and then they don't work anymore. You know, you know that it's a rubber shark, but then it never matters. Because Jaws is a work of genius. Yeah, I know it's a rubber shark. I know how that shot was made. I know that orca didn't that. And then you play Jaws and it works.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain small number of films that you can literally take them apart. And there's a brilliant line in a Billy Bragg song about the temptation to take the things we love apart must be resisted because you never put them back together again. And, you know, I know there are films for which that is true, but The Exorcist isn't one of them. It doesn't matter how much you dismantle it. When you press play, it just works.
And I think that's the thing here as well, is that I had been thinking about this, obviously, for the last 12 hours or something before talking about the movie. And I'd not noted down really any of the stuff that I'd said. The stuff that I'd noted down was just things that had happened or little thoughts. But the reading that I had hadn't been expressed until the microphone was on. And so it's clearly just working as a story and as a film. And then I've felt those things and sat with those feelings and those thoughts for 12 hours. Then opened my mouth and that's the stuff that's come out. Because clearly that's what it's connected with.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think it will connect with a different thing the next time I watch it.
I'm just delighted. It's just great because it's like we love the same film, but we love a different film. I mean, and then again, this comes back to something that Friedkin has always said. He said, you know, you take from The Exorcist what you bring to it, and
I think that's true with the best films.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely true. That's the reason why I think Marriage Story worked so well for me. It's the reason why Lost in Translation works, because you bring something to it. It's the reason, you know, why You Were Never Really Here works so well. And now I see what you're talking about with the little references to You Were Never Really Here that are within... Sorry, the references to The Exorcist that are within You Were Never Really Here.
Yeah.
Although Lynn Ramsey's probably half taking the piss by saying she doesn't know. But yeah, like I see all this stuff now, and I think a lot of these films, the best films in my opinion, are the ones that... It's difficult. You can't construct it really because it's all based on feeling. Is that when you're watching it, you feel like it's personally talking to something within you, an experience you've had or something you've felt.
Yeah. I love The other thing is, I mean, we should finish because we've been going on for ages. But the other thing which I love apart from everything that I love about it, I love I love the Georgetown setting. I love the Iraq prologue. I love the way in which the music is used so sparingly. But I love that the little jokey conversation between after Kinderman has said to Karis, this is the work of, this is like a satanic thing. This is like, you did a paper on witchcraft and blah, 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 blah. And he's basically saying to Karis, look, it's a sick priest. Okay. It's somebody in the priesthood, somebody with a grudge against the church. Okay. And Karis says, and they've had the little discussion about a priest would have come and confessed to him. And he says, is there anyone, that kind of thing? And Karis says, look, it's that's confidential. And Kinderman says, I don't want to worry you with the semantics, but a priest in sunny California, no less, was sent to prison for not telling the police what he knew about somebody, And Karis says, I mention it only in passing. And Karis says, I mention it only in passing. I could always tell the judge it was a matter of confession because that is different. Okay, so they have this kind of really fractious little thing. Okay. And then as they, at the beginning, when they first meet, Kinderman has said, you look like you're John Garfield in body and soul. You're like, and as he leaves, he says, I lied. You look like Sal Mineo. And Karis turns around and it's one of the very few moments in the film in which we see Karis laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this big beaming, is that, and there's the bit early on in the campus, but it's one of the very few moments in the film in which we see Karis laugh. And this, and it's only a fleeting shot. I lied.
But I can understand why as well, because you've seen it so many times. That those are the little details that when you know something so well, those are the things that stand out to you as like, oh, there's a little moment of who he is, like, or who he was, or who he can be, just there,
just for
a moment. And for the rest of the film, you're seeing him in tremendous amount of pain. So when you see that so often, I think that then you see those little moments, and you think, there he is. There's the real version of himself before he got caught up in all this stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That phrase you use, who he was. That's it. You see who he was. You see who he was, and it's lovely. And I think actually that's my favourite shot in the whole film. It's just that one moment, and he's turning. He's got the winds, and he just turns, and it's basically like the shot's maybe like a second long, and he just turns and he laughs. I like
it. Wouldn't have been as good if it was any longer.
No, exactly, because it's you don't even notice it. But it's just anyway. Well, yeah, look, Jack, this has been great, and I'm delighted that you got so much out of it. Not least because, it just makes me think that I'm still right about it. Still right.
I think I watched it and went, well, obviously it's brilliant. Like obviously, like from the beginning, I was like, oh yeah, this doesn't even feel like it was an old film. Again, I keep comparing it to Spielberg. It feels like Jaws. Like you watch Jaws and you go, this was made in 1977?
Five even. Is it Jaws? 75. 75, yeah.
Right. You watch it and you just go, this could have been made this year. Like, obviously the hairstyles are different, but that's kind of it.
Yeah.
The filmmaking holds up and the storytelling holds up. Like, whereas, like I said, I've been on a heist kick at the moment. And I watched the Sting.
Oh yeah, I love The Sting.
I didn't love it. It was just it felt like a warm up to the films that we get now. Like
that's interesting.
Not entirely, but like The Sting feels to me like a baggy. Like,
yeah. Well, look, I haven't seen The Sting in a very long time, because you know the thing about The Sting and The Exorcist, don't you?
What's that?
The Exorcist lost the Best Picture Oscar to The Sting.
Oh, wow. That's just completely coincidental that I've brought that up. I didn't even mean to start like
there
a 40-something-year-old beef, but yeah, I would have put The Exorcist any day.
Well, yeah, and that's it. That's the kind of, I love this thing. I saw it when I was a kid, and, I haven't seen it since it came out. And I'm sure now it is baggy and everything. But yeah, there's no way on earth that The Sting is better than The Exorcist. It's like It's like How Green Was My Valley and Citizen Kane. You go, well, I like How Green Was My Valley. It's not better than Citizen Kane, though, is it? It's like, let's be honest about this. All right, Jack. Well, listen, lovely to speak to you. And
nice to speak to you too.
Yeah, you know, the next thing we should do is you should give me, we should do a similar one the other way around. You should tell me a film that you love that I haven't seen that I should then, I owe you one now.
But how am I going to find a film that you haven't seen?
I'm sure there's loads of stuff that I haven't seen. Have a think about it, all right?
But I'll have a think about it. And even if it's something like, because I wanted you to rewatch something in our recently, I mentioned something that I wanted you to rewatch because you hated it. I think it was Burn After Reading. Like, I'd like to talk about that.
Okay, fine. Okay, that's what we'll do. I will go.
All right, great.
And also, that's quite easy because it's like 82 minutes long, right? It's really short.
Yeah.
Yeah, fine.
It's lovely. It's in and out. It gets the job done.
I will do Burn After Reading for you, okay? And then we'll reconvene. I guarantee.
Lovely.
I guarantee you it's not as good as The Exorcist.
It's not as good as The Exorcist, but it's fun.
All right. Well, there we are. That's me and Jack talking about The Exorcist. If you want to see a video version of this, as we said before, go to our Patreon page, including finding out what on earth that thing was about Marion's hand crawling around in the dark. Thanks ever so much for listening. Stay safe, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives, keep watching the skies, and tell your friends if you've enjoyed the podcast. Remember to subscribe. We do rely on your patronage, and we're very grateful for it. Thank you very much.